So I'd like to start actually and reiterate what Neil said this morning. But you know, thanks for coming. I'm glad you could come to PI for this. Thanks for spending your day at this meeting. And like he said, he didn't actually say it this way, but it was the same kind of a thought. I can't think of any of the physicists who work in this building who were not influenced by an outstanding teacher in their past. So it's really hard to overstate the influence you guys have, particularly in areas, science areas. So, you know, more power to you. So, my mandate today, Roberta gave me two mandates. One was to talk about, you know, what's new about the Large Hadron Collider, because there's, the talk that you might have seen before is about, you know, what people are looking for at the Large Hadron Collider, but the news this year was about the Higgs particle. The second thing Roberta asked me to do was not swear, and so, there's no cursing in the slides, so you'll actually be able to see the slides on the web. And so so the first part of this talk will be about the LHC. You know, what is it and what was it designed to do? But the last part of it is aimed at kind of what's happened in the last year about the Higgs particle. And you might have heard there was a news announcement in December about the Higgs particle, which you might have heard about. Who heard about that? So you've pretty much all seen the news. And so I want to tell you kind of what happened, what it is that they actually said that they saw. And a little bit has happened since. So in March, there was a new development. And there's going to be some more new developments I can't tell you about because I don't know what they are. But in July, there's a meeting in Australia that we expect things to be announced at. So you'll be prepared for that. So it's about the Higgs particle in particular, but the Large Hadron Collider in general. So the way I'll tell you that is to first talk about the LHC, and the recent events there is the breaking of it when they turned it on. And I want to tell you that story because that's affected how they've been running and how long it's taking them to do things. And it's also why they're focusing on the Higgs now and not looking for other things now. And so to tell you that story, you need to know how they broke it. And then the theory story will be, what were they trying to find when they built the LHC? And that's to do with the theory that we've had since the late 60s or early 70s, which works really well in particle physics, but not perfectly. And so they're really designed to see that, and in particular, to find the Higgs. One of the things that they hope to find is the Higgs, which the standard model predicts, but which has not been seen yet. And then I'll close out with the story of the last year. So what's new? What have they found? And then this is the part where you throw money, and then we're all happy. So the first start is the LHC, and so just to remind you what the machine is. And the machine is this 27-kilometer circumference tube in Switzerland, near Geneva. So I don't know if you can see this pointer here, but the city of Geneva is there, and there's Lake Geneva, and there's Mont Blanc in the background, in the Alps. It's a really lovely place. And you're kind of looking south here, and this big red ring is the LHC, and it's 27-kilometer tube in which protons are being accelerated in counter-rotating directions and colliding at various places. And it's big enough that you could see it from space, but you can't see it from space because it's underground. And so here's a slice-away view where you're now looking kind of towards the west rather than towards the south where we were before. So here's Geneva, and here's that ring again. And you see that there's these shafts that go down from the ground to this ring. And at the bottom of those shafts are letters. And these two here are the kind of the detectors that are the general purpose detectors that were built that I'll be describing. So the ATLAS detector is the one that all the Canadian physicists work on, and the CMS is the competitor. And then these other two big detectors, LHCb and ALICE, are kind of more special purpose detectors that also do interesting things. And I learned actually from Roberta that there's more than just these four detectors. There's actually a couple more smaller ones about which I know nothing. So you can ask her about that when we have wine and cheese. Okay, so you got this ring, you got these protons going around, and the protons are actually accelerated in this old accelerator, the SPS, the super proton synchrotron, that's actually on the CERN site. And then once they're going up to kind of what were high speeds, a couple decades ago, they're injected into the LHC where they're accelerated up to the highest speeds that have been reached yet on Earth. Okay, so the energies that they reach is the design energy was that each of those proton beams was supposed to have, each proton was supposed to have 7 TeV, tera electron volts, And you know, tera is a metric for, you know, a shitload. Yeah. And electron volt is the energy an electron gets when it falls through a volt, which is not so useful. But the way to think about it is that a giga electron volt is roughly the energy that you would get if you took the mass of a proton and you made it into pure energy. It's a little bit less than that. It's 0.94 or something like that, but it's roughly that. So a tera electron volt is 1,000 times that. So the design energy was these protons were each supposed to have about 7,000 times. Their kinetic energy was supposed to be about 7,000 times what you would have had if you took their rest mass and made it into pure energy. So they're very, very relativistic. They're moving very close to the speed of light. And that 7 TeV, you should remember, because each of the beams has 7 TeV. So when they collide, you have a total of 14 TeV available to you when things start to come out. And they haven't yet reached that energy, or they did, but then they broke it. And so what you'll see is that they're running at less than that energy now, and that has implications for what they're doing. So you know, these things are charged particles. They get them to, like any particles, they get them to go in a circle when they're going that fast. When they're, you need to have some sort of a force, and so they put these big magnets around the beam pipe to bend the protons to move in a circle. And I tell you that partly because the thing that actually broke when they broke it was the magnets. So here's a picture of some of the magnets. They're superconducting magnets. The tunnel that they're using is actually a retread from an earlier accelerator called LEP, the Large Electron Positron Collider, where they had electrons and positrons doing the same thing the protons are doing now. That was at lower energies. But because this is at higher energies, things are moving faster. The magnets had to be that much more powerful, and so they made them superconducting. And so superconducting magnets have to be kept at liquid helium temperature, so it's like 2 degrees Kelvin or something like that. And so this whole 27-kilometer ring is at 2 degrees Kelvin, and that's what keeps the magnets, the currents in the magnets flow without resistance, and then that what makes them powerful enough to bend the protons when they're at full energy. So if you took a cross-section through those magnets, you'd see that there's these two beam pipes. These, you know, there's the protons go one way there, and they go the other way there. And then at every once in a while, they're brought together to collide. And that does, and around those points is where they build these big detectors. Okay, so if you've seen the movie Angels and Demons, then you've seen CERN and you've seen the LHC. And I don't know if you've seen the movie The Angels and Demons, but and I don't necessarily recommend you do see the movie Angels and Demons. It's not a bad movie. I like it better than the book. Here's a picture of the people in the movie. They actually went to CERN and they stood in front of this building here, which is kind of an iconic CERN building, to prove that they were in CERN. And that building there, and this is the lab, CERN again. You're looking now north here, so the Alps would be below us. Geneva's over here somewhere. And that big ring of the LHC would come around like that, and it goes off, you know, way over to the right somewhere. And underneath those buildings there is basically the Atlas detector. So one of those shafts that goes down to the LHC is right around on that road. And the French-Swiss border actually runs right through the middle here. And this little round thing here, that building there is the one that they're standing in front of. It's kind of it's the outreach building. It's one of the public relations buildings that people see when you come in on a tour. And when they shot the movie, they actually shot the movie here. And so I stole some frames from the movie to compare it. So this is the opening scene of the movie. You remember, it starts off, you see that building actually with the Alps behind them. But the Alps are enormous because they want to really emphasize that you're near the Alps, whereas in real life the Alps are kind of in the distance, like they would have been in Calgary. The next thing that happens is they do a zoom into this tunnel, very spectacularly. It goes down, and then you come out and you see the LHC in all its glory. And this is the tunnel they zoom down, and they actually did zoom down the real tunnel. That's the shaft that goes beneath that building at CERN I showed you to Atlas, the detector Atlas. And that's a picture I took down that same shaft. And at the bottom there, that's the Atlas detector, that blue thing. And that's, you can see it in the movie there too. And so what you don't see in these pictures is how big this thing is. So what you should think of is think of the Parliament buildings in Ottawa, and think of the Peace Tower as being the shaft. So you're at the top of the Peace Tower looking down a hole, which is like the Peace Tower, what it would have been if it was hollow. And then this detector down there, the Atlas detector, is like the east block of the Parliament building. It's like a four-story building. And it's, so it's really huge. You know, it would fill this room and more. And so it's really, really spectacularly big, this detector, for reasons that I'll get to in a second. So then in the movie, what happens is you come out of that zoom and then you see the detector, and then you go through this glass wall that you can see here into the control room. which is full of physicists, as you can tell, because they're bald and they're wearing lab coats. Yeah. And if you look at the real control room, it looks like this. It's full of people that look like us. You know, it's a bunch of middle-aged kind of Europeans, North Americans. Actually, it's a very mixed group in CERN now. It's from all over the world. But it's on the ground. It's not down next to the detector. No one's allowed down next to the detector when it's running because it's radioactive and it would be dangerous to be down there. So they lock it all off. And the control room's on the surface, and there's it's all controlled by computers from the surface. So there's a lot of it doesn't. I was brought up in the Apollo 11 generation, and I thought that the mission control was the ultimate in technology. If you ever go to Houston and see mission control, it's really disappointing. It's all these nested LED lights that were kind of before they had LEDs, or these nested little tube lights. This is just really a bunch of laptops and screens that you could imagine a gamer having in their basement. And there's several of them there, and they're all monitoring the detector. So then in the movie, they're running everything, and then they produce particles, and they're easy to see because they glow in the dark, and they look like that. And of course, that's not true. That's why these detectors are so big. You get that idea of the scale here now. This is a CMS detector, and this is a crane that was being used. This is when they were still building it. So this tube here is where the protons go, and they kind of assemble it around that, and so it's hermetically sealing around where this interaction point is. And this is the ATLAS detector. They haven't yet put in the tube where the protons will go, but it goes down that hole there. And these big tubes on the outside are big magnets because the detectors also have big magnets in them. And you can see that each of these lines here is a story. So there's a set of stairs here. So a person is about that high. I don't know if you can see a person in there, but that's kind of roughly gives you an idea. So it's really a four-story building plus stuff around the edges. So it's enormous. Okay, so why is it the detector so big? So it's a big complicated thing. Here's the standard little person, and it gives you again the scale. And you see that this is the ATLAS detector now, and here's the beam pipe, and these colors are kind of showing you the things that are inside there. These are the tubes that we're looking at, were the big magnets. And so the reason that these things are complicated is that all these particles that come out are invisible, so you don't see them. And there's good news and bad news about that, because the good news is if you kind of go back to 100 years ago when people were, Rutherford was shooting alpha particles at nuclei and stuff came out. If a neutron came out, then the belief was, well, that neutron was actually in there already, so that you've knocked something out of the nucleus that used to be there. And so the philosophy was it's like colliding cars and looking at the spray of parts and figuring out what was inside the car. And that's the way it used to work, but that's not the way it works now. Once you're at this relativistic energies, where you've got much more energy than the rest mass of a particle, then you can for free produce pretty much any particle, and it's any particle out of nothing, out of photons or some regular particles that you're colliding. Any regular particles you're colliding can pretty much produce pretty much any other particle, and it's any particle because there's enough energy to do it. And so the good news is you don't need to design, choose the particles you're colliding to get specific particles out, because it doesn't really matter what's inside the particles you're colliding. You're going to get everything out. All possible particles that could be produced will be produced. So that's good. The bad news is that all those particles decay in 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So moving at the speed of light, they're lucky to cross a nucleus before they decay. So in this detector, you're not seeing those new particles coming out here. They're not designing the detector to see the new particles. They're seeing the particles that the new particles decayed into, which are just garden variety particles. It's electrons and protons and muons and neutrons. There's a list of about 6 or 7 that are the ones that we find around us in nature. And essentially that's all that comes out to a good approximation. And so the name of the game is you have to reconstruct what was produced based on what it decayed into. And it's kind of complicated because what it decayed into is something which was around anyway. And so you want to make sure that you can figure out which particles came out, so you have to be able to identify different particles. You have to be able to tell an electron from a photon, say. And you have to know what was their energy and how much momentum did they have. And that's kind of why these things are hermetic. They're trying to make it so that there's no cracks into which you could lose things. And then the different pieces are there to identify the different particles. So, and what they rely on is that different particles interact differently with matter. So the rule is essentially the more strongly you interact, then the more you like to stop. So I'll give you an example of that in a second. But if you take part in the strong interactions, So you interact with nuclear forces, and that's actually a very efficient way to scatter if you can hit a nucleus. But if not, you still hit electrons, but you might lose energy less efficiently because you're interacting more weakly. But balanced against that is the heavier you are, the more it's harder to stop you, which you kind of know that if you're hit by a mosquito or you're hit by a train, the train is harder to stop. And so so electrons will be easier to stop, say, than protons will be. And so but on the other hand, protons are strongly interacting and electrons are not, so there's a balance that goes on. And so what happens is they design these detectors to stop the different kinds of particles, and depending on which part of the detector gets hit, then you know which kind of particle it was. So in the middle part here, right around where the interaction happens, they have all these high voltage connections, which are designed to see charged particles. So if you have an electrically charged particle, it releases a current, and you can actually see the track. So you can actually map out a particle went there, a particle went there, a particle went there. But you can't do it for electrically neutral particles, because they don't ionize the material that is producing these tracks. But then if you get out to the green area, that's an area that's designed to stop things that interact only electromagnetically. So photons and electrons normally will stop there, and they run out of gas. So you catch all their energy. But a proton and a neutron, which is heavier than an electron, they punch right through and they get into the orange area, and the orange area is kind of made of denser stuff, which will stop the protons and neutrons too. And then there's some things, muons are particles like electrons that are more massive, but they're really like electrons, so they don't see the nuclear force. So they actually penetrate farther because they're more heavy, they're more massive than the electron, say, but unlike the proton, which is also more massive, they don't strongly interact. So they actually get out of everything and they hit these blue things. So the thing you actually see when you see the detector is the muon detectors on the outside. And they're designed to both see muons that are going out, but they also see muons that are coming in from space, because like once a minute or so, there's a muon that comes through you coming from cosmic rays hitting the top of the atmosphere. And so if you see something coming from the outside, they don't count that as an event. They only look at the things that are coming from the inside. So the way you tell particles apart is an electron is charged, so you see it in the middle, and it stops in the green area. So you only see it in those two areas. Whereas a photon is not charged, but also stops in the green area. So you can tell them apart depending if you see something only lighting up the inner part of the detector, it was a photon or an electron, and you tell the difference by seeing if it lit up the middle, the very central part, which sees the charge of the particle. And then a proton would light up all three because it's charged, it goes right through here, so it leaves some energy, but then it leaves the rest of its energy there. Whereas a neutron doesn't leave a track because it's not charged, but it does dump its energy in the orange and green areas. And then a muon goes right out through, it's charged, so you see it here, and you see it here, and you also see it out here. And then neutrinos, you don't see them at all. And neutrinos, if you haven't heard about them, they're another kind of a particle that's around, but they don't take part in the electromagnetic or the nuclear interactions, and so they're very weakly interacting. And we're being bombarded with them from the sun all the time. Every square centimeter, every second, there's 10 billion neutrinos coming through at the Earth's surface coming from the sun. So there's an enormous amount of neutrinos coming out of the sun. And you know how many there are because you know how bright the sun is and you know how many nuclear reactions there are. And they're being produced because the sun is being driven by fusion. And so that's turning hydrogen into helium. So you're making neutrons out of something. So you're turning protons and electrons and making them into neutrons and a neutrino, it turns out. So every time you make a proton into a neutron, you produce a neutrino, which escapes because it doesn't interact much. And that's why they're hitting us. But you know exactly how many there should be. And the fact that you don't know that they're there shows you how weakly interacting they are. So you don't see them, but you know that they're there, because if you see an event where all the particles come out one side, say, you know that momentum is not being balanced, so something must have gone out the other side that you didn't see. And so then you figure that could have been a neutrino. But to test that, you how many times that should happen, and so you compare that to what the theory tells you should have happened. And if it happened more often, then you know can't be just a neutrino, it might be something else. So that's the logic of the detector, and it works really well. And here's an example of an event where they've got two electrons and two muons, and the two muons you see light up everything, including the muon detectors, and the two electrons only light up the middle part here. And the momenta kind of basically balance. You can't balance the momenta along the beam pipe because you can't measure the stuff. They can't put the detector into the beam pipe without destroying it. So they never really can count the energy along the beam, but they look at the transverse momentum when they look at this balance of energy momentum. Okay, so that was so it was a lot harder to detect particles than it was in the movie. The other thing, the biggest thing the movie got wrong, this is my favorite line of this whole talk, is that in the movie, when they turned the LHC on, it worked. Whoops. Like my slides didn't work here. So the, sorry, so it worked. And in real life, it didn't work. It turned it on, it worked for a while, worked for about a week, and then it broke. And so I told you I wanted to tell you how that happened, and this is where I'll tell it to you, because the main message here is that because it broke, they haven't fixed it, because that would take about a year and a half. And they knew that they could actually do something useful like find the Higgs first, because that doesn't require, until they fix it, they can't run at the full energy. And finding the Higgs doesn't require the full energy of the design energy of the LHC. Finding other things does, but finding the Higgs doesn't require energy. So they figured we'll find the Higgs first, and then we'll fix it. And so so I want to take you through what happened and why they went through that line of thought. So the incident happened in the same picture where the Alps are down there. We're looking south. The incident happened over here. It's near the foot of the Jura Range. And what happened was to do with where the magnets connected to each other. So there's thousands of magnets that are down there. And here, this is them when hadn't been put down there yet. Each one of them is lowered down this hole and then put onto the trolley and then driven around the ring on a train, which travels at 3 kilometers an hour. And so it takes a long time to get to the other side of the ring sometimes. And one of the occupational hazards is that the drivers of the train often fall asleep when they're taking this thing around because it's really, really boring. And so there's lots of them. They all have to be welded together. Here's the connection between two magnets. And you see it's complicated. It's really all you're supposed to see there. But in there somewhere is a bus bar, this copper bus bar there. And it's welded. The joint is welded. And you see in the x-rays here that some of the welds weren't very good. And that was the source of the problem. And to see why that was a problem, you need to know what the bus bar is for. And so you might have thought that because it's copper, it was some sort of a wire or something carrying current. And that's almost right, except for the superconducting current, this is actually the insulator. So they have it next to this is not what carries the superconducting current for the superconducting magnets. There's something else that does that. But they have the copper next to it. And as far as the superconducting current is concerned, the copper is an insulator. And so it doesn't travel in the superconducting current. But so if this red line here is the superconducting the current carrier and the yellow is the copper, then the idea is that when everything's working, the superconducting thing is carrying all the current because there's no resistance there. But the copper is there in case something goes wrong. And it's not unusual for these things to go wrong because sometimes what happens is that the liquid helium boils and so that the temperature rises and they stop superconducting spontaneously. That's called a quench. And when that happens, they have to be able to, they don't want to destroy the thing. So what they do is, the idea is that the current that was traveling in the superconducting wire jumps to the copper, which is now a big, solid, robust thing that can carry current without destroying it. It can dissipate the energy. And then you carry it off the ground somewhere and you don't do any damage. And so you can kind of see that that's all fine, provided that the welds between the coppers and the different magnets are working fine. But if you don't have a good weld there and so that the current can't get from one magnet to the other, everything's great as long as everything's superconducting, which is what happened for the first week. But then as soon as you have a quench and one of the magnets no longer superconducts, then the current tries to get onto the copper. It does this successfully until it gets to the end of the magnet, and then it has to go somewhere, and it can't get out. And so what it does is it basically picks the magnet up and puts it over and puts it down again. And these things are all screwed into the concrete. So there's really kind of an enormous amount of energy that's released. And all the magnets are tied to each other. So you do that with one of them, the next one goes over, the next one goes over, and they all kind of topple. And so they got more than they bargained for when they had a quench because of these bad welds. So, and it's not just the damage. It's also, this whole tube that protons are in is a vacuum pipe because you don't want these protons to be hitting things that you've very expensively made them have a lot of energy. You want them only to collide when they're inside a detector. And of course, all this crud that came from the moving this the magnets over went down this vacuum tube. And this is a picture looking down the tube. It's supposed to be pink because that's what copper looks like in these pictures, but it was just all soot and stuff like that. So they had to fix all that in order to run the beam again. So they did do some repairs. They replaced some magnets, the ones that had really been dramatically damaged, and they cleaned up the vacuum pipe. But they didn't replace all the magnets because they have a problem that in order to fix the welds, they have to heat it up to room temperature, and then they fix it and then they cool it down again. And that whole process takes, months. They have to retrain the magnets. But they warm up the ring in octants. So there's 8 different octants they'd have to do that for. And then when they do that, of course, all the liquid helium boils. And they have to put that helium somewhere. And there's not enough storage for all that helium in that whole 27-kilometer ring. So they'd have to put it into trucks and drive it away and then drive it back again. So they decided that that whole process would take so long, and it has been decades in the building, this machine, that they would fix what they had to fix. And then they'd see where the, once they knew what the problem was, they could figure out where these welds were bad by measuring the resistance between these magnets. And that's, I think, micro ohms between the magnets when it's warm, but when it's at liquid helium, when it's liquid nitrogen temperatures, it's nano ohms. And so what they did is they went around and they measured all this resistance and they figured out which ones had a problem. And they fixed some of them, but some of the octants they never warmed up. And so they, because they haven't been fixed, they figured out how high an energy they could run it at without coming into trouble with the with having a catastrophic failure if they have a quench of the magnets. And they decided that they could run it at half the design energy. So instead of each of these protons having 7 TeV, they each had 3.5 TeV. And so when they collided all together, there was 7 TeV in the collision. And they've been doing that for now a number of years. And this year, they've raised it a little bit. They're actually colliding 4 TeV on 4 TeV. They've been doing that since about a month ago. And they as of last week, they have had as many collisions as they have had, they had had up until the whole running of the LHC till last summer. So a fifth of what they ran, they had until last Christmas. And they're going to run essentially all year, and they're going to stop at Christmas this year, and then they're going to fix it. And they'll take a year and a half or something like that, and they'll do it right and turn it back on, and they'll run it at the full energy. So in the meantime, they have to look for things that don't require the full energy, but require lots and lots of collisions. And I want to convince you in the rest of the talk that the Higgs particle is something you can do that way. And so the main thing is that the Higgs particle, I want to have to argue for you, is not very heavy. So it's actually being produced all the time. Probably was being produced all the time in the previous accelerator in Fermilab. What's hard about finding the Higgs particle is not producing it. It's seeing that it's there amongst all the other stuff that you produce. And so to see it's there, I want to convince you in the rest of the talk, requires lots of statistics, and so lots and lots of events. And so that's kind of why they've been running at a lower energy for longer and focusing on getting more and more collisions to happen. So they have been running for a while. This is 2009, I guess it was, when they got things going again at this half the energy. And this is graph is supposed to show you that the accelerator is working really well except for the energy part. So they're accumulating lots of events. So this graph is actually supposed to be a graph of across the bottom is time, and this is just time in 2011. So this is in the early part of the year till mid year of 2011. And what they're telling you here is that the number of collisions that they've had to look at in the LHC, and the green histogram is showing you there's more and more collisions happening. And the yellow one is showing you the ones that the detectors saw. So the fact that they're very close to each other is showing you that they're not missing many of the collisions. They don't waste many collisions. The detectors see most of them. And they're telling you in kind of bizarre units here how many collisions they had. An inverse femtobarn is telling you the total number of collisions that have taken place to that point. And I want to take a detour now for a couple of slides to explain that unit, because when we're talking about the Higgs, they're going to be trying to make an argument that they've seen the Higgs. And they're going to need to do that in terms of the probability of the Higgs being produced. And that's all phrased in terms of the cross-section for the reaction that produces the Higgs, and then the Higgs decays into something. And so this unit, the femtobarn, is related to the measure of probability of a reaction, the cross-section, in a way that I want to explain for a few slides, because it sets up what we'll talk about when we're talking about what they actually did when they saw the Higgs. So at the end of the next few slides, this statement saying that they've had an inverse femtobarn of events will hopefully make sense. But it's just basically a unit telling you how many events they've seen. A very convenient unit. So to think about what a cross-section is and to what those units are, you should think about what it is that physically determines the rate with which reactions happen when you collide two bunches of protons. So think of these are the protons going one way, these are the protons going the other way. We want to know the reaction rate, which is the number of reactions per unit time. And we want to know how it depends on the number of protons in each bunch and how fast they're moving and things like that. So what we have to do is figure out the number of reactions and divide that by the time interval over which we counted those interactions. And so the way to think about it is what we'll do is we'll think about, there's not that many protons in each bunch, so we can think about each one independently. So we'll think about the likelihood of this one proton here hitting one of the protons in this other bunch. And then once we're finished, we'll multiply it by the number of things in this first bunch. And so I'm gonna write down a formula. And the formula is going to say, what I'm about to say now in words, is that we'll we're going to get something which is the likelihood of this proton hitting one of these guys. What you should do, Sue, is think of a tube which starts with this proton. It's this tube that the proton sweeps out as it moves through this other bunch. And so it sweeps out a volume in this other bunch. And you can think of the number of protons that it hits as being essentially the density of protons here, the number of protons divided by the volume of the bunch, times the volume that's swept out by this proton in the time we've looked at it. So in equations, here's our volume. Imagine that it's got a cross-sectional area, which we'll call cross-section, sigma, and it sweeps out a distance delta x in some time delta t. So then the likelihood of there being a reaction will be the number of protons in this bunch, that's n1, times the likelihood of this one proton to interact with the other bunch, and that's the volume here that has been swept out, the cross-sectional area, sigma, times the length, delta x, that's the volume of that cylinder, and then times the density of this bunch, which is the number of protons in that bunch divided by its volume. And then to get the rate, we divided by the time delta t that we're looking at. And I'm going to use that the distance traveled here, delta x, divided by delta t, that's just the speed of the protons. So if I just group all those terms, then what you have here, so I've just taken everything rewritten again, and I wrote v for delta x over delta t, that's that v there. And everything except for this cross-sectional area is what's called luminosity. And then this cross-section is kind of the width of the proton, the way I was describing it. And the reason that you group things that way is that the first factor is the something which is a property of the accelerator. It's the number of things in each bunch, it's how fast they're moving, it's how big the bunches are. It's the things that the accelerator people try to adjust to make you have more and more collisions. And the cross-section itself, sigma here, is a property of the interaction that we're talking about. I kind of talked about it as being the geometrical size of the proton. But you know, if the proton is electrically charged, and it could have interacted with an electrically charged proton that was not actually physically hitting it, because they could just scatter through the long-distance Coulomb force. So what you should think about for the cross-section is not that it's the physical size of the object, but it's a measure of how big the object effectively is, which is taking into account how effective it is at interacting with things. So if you can interact with things at a distance, the cross-section will be larger than the physical size. If it's very inefficient at interacting with things, the cross-section could be smaller than its size, for instance, for a neutrino. And so the thing that you want to measure as a particle physicist is the cross-section for some reaction that we're interested in looking at. And that's the thing that in the Higgs measurements they're going to tell you. They're going to tell you the cross-section for the protons to collide to produce a Higgs particle and for it to decay in a particular way. And they're going to tell it to you in these units. And in the meantime, all the accelerator people are trying to make these things as large as possible to get more and more and more events to happen. So now the units of these things you can tell just by looking at this formula. It's just all lengths and times. And so the units of luminosity are 1 over length squared, 1 over time. So that's inverse centimeter squared per second. And of course, the units of a cross-section is an area, so it's a centimeter squared. And those are really crappy units in particle physics because, you know, we're not talking about centimeter-sized things. So what people use instead is a barn. A barn is defined to be 10 to the minus 24 centimeter squared. And that's because that's roughly the size of the area of a proton is 10 to the minus 24 centimeter squared. Or a nucleus is that size, say. It's called a barn because it's one of these corny physics jokes. It's kind of based on couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And so they're talking about the likelihood of collisions, and so they called it a barn. And so there you are. You know, I don't make them up. I just pass them on. And so that's the basic unit, a barn. And so now a femto barn is just, you know, femto is metric for 10 to the minus 15, and pico is 10 to the minus 12. And so it's just a fraction of that. So that's what we're talking about when you talk about a femto barn. That's the measure of a cross-sectional area. And a barn is the typical size of a nucleus, so it's a typical size of a cross-section for a nuclear interaction. And so the reactions we're talking about are much more rare, so we talk about femto barns and pico barns. Whereas luminosity is going to be in inverse centimeter squared per inverse second, so you could think of that as being inverse barns per inverse second. And if you ask how much collisions you've had over a particular amount of time, you're going to multiply by time, and that'll be something which is inverse area. And that's measured in inverse femto barns. And that's a very useful unit, because if you've collected an inverse femto barn worth of collisions, then if you have a reaction whose cross-section is a femto barn, then you're expecting to have seen that reaction once. If you've collected 1,000 inverse femto barns of reactions, and you've got a reaction whose cross-section is a femto barn, then you're expecting to have seen that reaction happen 1,000 times. So it's a very direct way of telling you how likely the events are given the cross-sections for the events you're looking for. So the message is that what they had last summer was an inverse femto barn of collisions. That is what they've accumulated in the whole history of the LHC to that point. So something with a cross-section of a femtoburn, they would have seen happen once. In the fall of 2011, they got another 4 inverse femtoburns. So by Christmas, they had 5 inverse femtoburns. And since they turned it on in March until now, they've got another inverse femtoburn. They're expecting to have another 4 before June, and then they'll have more in the fall. So the machine's working really well, and they're the first factor that is the accelerator part, they're getting really good at making big. And so they're getting more and more and more things to collide. Good, enough of that. They're doing lots of good science. They're not seeing anything, which is not quite wet, so that's not quite true. People say they're not seeing anything. What's happening is they're seeing nothing, which is different for an experimentalist. Because it's not that supersymmetry is there and they're not seeing it. They're telling you that supersymmetry is not there, where they looked for it. And so they're really excluding lots of things, even though they've not seen a new thing yet. And so they're writing lots of papers and there's lots of activity going on. It's not as exciting as we hope it will be when they see something new, but they've told us lots of things already that are very interesting, just from the things they haven't seen. So it's the dog that didn't bark, which is the interesting thing so far. So what are they hoping to see? Well, that's set by the standard model. And so I want to take a detour here in the standard model to tell you why we think it's good, and then also why we don't think it's the right theory, and so it's worth looking for a change to it. So it's in the philosophy of looking for what things are made out of, and we know that, you know, things are made out of atoms. Atoms are made out of nuclei and electrons. The nuclei are made out of protons and neutrons. The protons and neutrons are made of quarks and gluons. And as far as we know, that's it. The quarks, the gluons, and the electrons they're consistent with not having any substructure, as far as we know, to the distances we've seen. And now, by having higher energies, you're looking at smaller distances, and the hope is to see something new. So that's the plan. And the theory that describes the particles that we think are elementary now is made by these guys. This is Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg. Glashow did his work in the early 60s, in 61 or 62, and Weinberg and Salam did theirs in 67 and 68, and there was a gap in between, which was a long, puzzling period where no one knew what was going on, and that's where the Higgs mechanism was invented and solved the problem that the standard model had, which I'm about to describe. And the story as to why Glashow didn't get it all himself and why Weinberg and Salam had to get involved to make this theory work is the story of the Higgs mechanism and this particle, the Higgs particle, that they're looking for in the LHC. So in the standard model, these are the things that everything we've seen in nature so far has been built out of. The green things are quarks. They're the things that take part in the strong interactions. The blue things are the electron and the neutrino we talked about and their friends. They don't take part in the strong interactions. The red things are the forces that these guys take part in. Some of them do. So the strong interactions are mediated by gluons. The electromagnetic interactions are mediated by photons. And then the W and the Z particle mediate weak interactions, which describe radioactive decays and things like fusion, where you make a proton and a neutron and turn a proton into a neutron, proton electron into a neutron. So that's the whole story. Everybody we see in everyday life is the first column. So the proton is 2 ups and a down quark, and a neutron is 2 downs and an up. And the electron is, so atoms are made of ups and downs and electrons together with gluons and photons. And these neutrinos are there from radioactive decays. We know that from the sun. And then one of the puzzles of the standard model that no one really understands is that these other things that are only really produced in accelerators and don't seem to play any role in nature as we see it around us are basically exact copies of the first things, but heavier. So the muon that I talked about that gets through the detector out to the outside is an electron, literally an electron, but a heavy one. And there's another one called the tau particle, which is even heavier, but it's otherwise identical to an electron. And really, no one knows why there's 3 copies of everything, but that seems to be the pattern. And the standard model is, so these are the things that are inside all the particles we know about. And the standard model is made of those things plus this one particle that hasn't been seen, the Higgs particle. And so I want to, in the next slides, motivate for you why there's such a strong, it's not like there's an option to have this Higgs particle or not in the standard model. There's really a problem without the Higgs particles. The standard model requires the Higgs particle, and it really doesn't make sense without the Higgs particle. So that's what the next few slides will be about. So to set that up, there's an experimental fact that the standard model builds in, which it's not a prediction of the standard model, but it's, Glashow, when he was making up the rules, had a lot of experiments to work with. So an example of a reaction that happens in the standard model is a muon decays, and essentially 99% of the time or more, it decays into an electron and 2 neutrinos, actually a neutrino and an antineutrino. And the way to think about that is that the muon goes along and it emits a W particle and turns into a muon neutrino. And then the W particle turns into an electron and it decays into an electron and an antineutrino. So you end up with a muon going to an electron plus a couple of neutrinos. And what's known, that's been very well measured, this reaction. That's essentially the way that muons live for a microsecond, and they decay almost always this way. And a lot's known about the reaction, and you can measure this, how it depends on the spin. The muon and the electron have spin, and you can measure how this reactions depend on the spin by measuring the directions the electron goes and the neutrinos go. And so you can figure out how everything depended on spin by looking carefully at how the decay products leave the muon when they leave. And the experimental fact is that you can label spin as left or right-handed. So if you think of a particle that's moving that way, so my thumb is the direction of motion, and it's spinning that way, that's a right-handed particle. Whereas if it was going this way and spinning that way, that's a left-handed particle. And so the two spins that you could have are relative to the direction of motion are defined left and right-handedness. And the rule is, experimentally, that only left-handed particles take part in the weak interactions. So only the left-handed muon is involved in that decay that I showed you in the previous slide. And that's just experimental fact. Now, that's weird because the way I describe handedness doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, if I describe handedness by saying that, so we all think that this particle is moving this way and it's spinning that way, so it's right-handed, that's great. But if I now come run through the room faster than that particle, as far as I'm concerned, it's going that way. And so, but it's still spinning that way, so I think it's actually left-handed because it's going that way and it's going spinning that way. So that means that handedness doesn't really make sense as a label for a particle if it's not moving at the speed of light, because I can always, if it's not moving at the speed of light, I can always go faster than it, and then I should be able to have a perfectly good label too, and we should all be able to agree on the labels of particles. And so handedness makes sense for a massless particle that moves at the speed of light because nobody can go faster than you then. So everybody agrees that you're going that way, and so then you're spinning that way, and so everybody agrees what your handedness is. And so the puzzle that Glashow had was, on the one hand, the experimental facts of the weak interactions seemed to say that handedness was important for the weak interactions, and yet the electron and the muon have a mass, and so they don't move at the speed of light, and so that handedness didn't seem to make sense as a label for them. And so how could that possibly make sense? It seemed like the whole theory would make sense if everybody was moving at the speed of light, but they're not. And so there was a real puzzle in how do you reconcile the facts of the weak interaction with the fact that everybody doesn't move at the speed of light. And that's what the Higgs mechanism was designed to fix. It was invented by all these people. So this is Peter Higgs. He's the guy who explained it in a way that everybody got. When he gave a bunch of seminars that people really understood what he's talking about. He had a very simple model. But all these other people were there and often first. And if it comes down to a Nobel Prize, there'll be an interesting story there that will play out. So what is this mechanism? So what they're trying to do is understand how it could possibly be true that you could have handedness or the weak interactions make sense if you're not moving at the speed of light. And the trick was they phrased it as a symmetry. It's always useful to phrase the predictions of a theory as a symmetry because normally what happens is you say, I think a theory predicts this because I calculate something, and I say, well, this is what the theory says should happen. And if you're wrong, the first thing you think is, well, I probably just calculated it wrong. And so you go back and you recalculate it and you have your students calculate it and then you see if everybody agrees. And then it takes a while to be confident that you've really made a good prediction. But if you have a symmetry consequence, then it's like you get the answer for free. There's a whole bunch of things you can conclude where you don't have to actually work anything out. You just know that it's a very general statement and exact things follow, like conservation of charge, for instance. There's a symmetry that underlies that. Conservation of energy and momentum follow from symmetries. That's why we believe they're not really going to be found wrong because somebody recalculates something and says, oh, crap, energy's not conserved after all. There's a really deep symmetry understanding for all the conservation laws that we know about. And you can phrase this issue of things moving at the speed of light in the weak interactions as a symmetry, that the electron and the neutrino are related by a symmetry, even the neutrino is moving at the speed of light and the electron isn't. How do you understand that? And what these guys did is they gave a way of understanding how inferences based on symmetries could fail. There's actually a hidden assumption everybody makes when they make inferences based on symmetries, which hadn't been articulated. And it's a very insightful thing that they said. And basically what you need to think about is when you say there's a symmetry, you say there's one particle gets related to another particle in a way which is special. And what you're always assuming when that happens is that when you have a particle in particle physics, if you took that particle away, then what you have is the vacuum. And you're normally used to thinking of the vacuum as being the absence of everything. But a part of physicists don't think of it that way. They think of it as being the lowest energy state. And it may or may not have particles in it, but it's the lowest energy state. And implicit in everybody's assumptions was that when you make this particle into another particle, the lowest energy state, the vacuum, didn't do anything interesting. And that's perfectly natural if it's just the absence of everything. But if it's a physical thing, you have to ask, does that transformation that related the particles also change the vacuum? And the observation the Higgs people, the Higgs and his friends made was that the vacuum actually can ruin the properties that would have allowed you to infer that everybody had to be massless in the standard model. So you should think of the vacuum as a physical thing. It's like water. We're moving through it. And like things moving through water, different things have different resistance. And that's actually a terrible way to say it. This is one of the fights Roberta and I probably had. Is that saying it this way, and this is the way I used to say it, makes it sound like friction is involved. And that's actually not what's going on. The way to think about the way moving through a medium gives you a mass is to think that it's not surprising that moving through a medium could give you an energy, that there's an energy of interaction there. And if any time there's an energy, then Einstein says that there's a mass associated with that, which is the energy divided by c squared. And so that's the way to think about mass. We move through, the vacuum has physical properties, and as we move through the vacuum, we interact with it. Different particles interact with it differently, and so they have different interaction energies, and we interpret that as a mass because it's an energy they have, and if you didn't know the vacuum was there, you'd think it's a particle, it's an energy that particle has just when it's sitting there, which is what we call mass, which is what we call rest mass. And so the idea was that the inference that particles had to be massless and move at the speed of light would have been true if the vacuum didn't have properties. And so there's a very deep statement being made about the vacuum. It's not the absence of things. It has physical properties, and our motion through it is what gives us mass. And if that's true, you don't get to just make shit up in physics. There's always a consequence. I'm going for three. And that's because if you say that the vacuum has physical properties, then we know that things can't move faster than the speed of light. If I hit the vacuum or I heat it up, I should be able to alter the vacuum. If it's like water, I could boil it. And it's actually true in the standard model. In the early universe, when it was hot, things did move at the speed of light because it's like the vacuum boils. But if you change the vacuum, if you hit it with a wrench, the news that it's been hit has to move through space at some speed, not faster than light. So there have to be waves in the vacuum if the vacuum has physical properties. And that's something which you have no option about if you're assigning physical properties to the vacuum. And those waves, the quanta of those waves, are the Higgs particles that people are looking for. So the logic of the Higgs mechanism is that there's this great theory of the weak interactions, except that it seemed to say that everybody had to be moving at the speed of light. Unless the vacuum has physical properties and our motion through it gives us the energy which we interpret as being mass. And then we can have our cake and eat it too. We can have the weak interactions and have things not move at the speed of light, but only if we're moving through a physical vacuum. But if that vacuum is there and it has physical properties, then it has to have waves, and those waves should be visible. And so if you see the Higgs particle, it's not just like one more particle on the list. It's really cool particle because it's telling you that the vacuum has physical properties and you've made it wiggle. So it's like if the vacuum was jello and you dinged it, then the wiggles you see are the Higgs particles. So, great. What time am I aiming for here? Now. This is my third swearing thing, right? Okay, so I'll skip through this very quickly, the successes and limitations part. It's basically the short version is the theory works really well, and mostly I'll go right to a table here. So this is a bunch of things that are measured. This is a bunch of things that are theoretically calculated in the standard model, and there's essentially three parameters in the standard model that are responsible for the agreement of all these things. So the fact that you get even close tells you that the picture is basically right. And then when you do a statistical fit to the observations, it works at a quantitative level, which you can see is better than a part per thousand. Sometimes it's better than a part in a million. And it's an amazing feat that when the experimentalists, when they did this measurement, one of the things they found was that one of the things here is the mass of the Z boson. They used to get that in the old experiment in the LHC tunnel where they had the electrons and positrons colliding because it would make a Z boson. And so they measured that mass by measuring the energy of the electron and positron beam very carefully. And they found that they got a really good agreement here, but only on weekdays. And it never worked on the weekend. And that really bothered them, and as you might imagine. And so it turned out that they figured out there's a pattern that it didn't work on the weekends, but only at specific times on the weekend. And it turned out to be when the TGV, the fast train from Geneva to Lyon, was going by, their measurements never worked. And they figured out why. It was because the trains are electrically driven in France, and all the current is trying to go to ground when the train goes by. And the ground in Geneva is basically Lake Geneva. And a really good way to get there, if you're an electron, is this big iron or metal ring underneath the ground near Geneva, which has an accelerator in it. And so the current goes there, and it changes all the calibrations of the energy of the beam, and so that's why they got the mass wrong. So the precision of these measurements is really phenomenal. They can see the moon go overhead because the moon, the tidal forces flex the crust, and they change the dimensions of the ring in a measurable way. So they really, it's a complete tour de force that they can measure these things as well. And it's a very, very successful theory. And the most important thing for this talk that you need to know about that is that it tells you how heavy the Higgs particle is. Because I told you, you're trying to find it. It's the vacuum waves. But you might have thought, well, if it's very, very heavy, we may not be able to produce it at the LHC. And so then we're screwed. And this is showing you that this is the W mass. The mass of the W particle is something you actually get to calculate in the standard model. And this is the Higgs mass. And this is a kind of a different scale. This is a log scale. This is 100 GeV, so 100 times the mass of the proton. This is 1,000. Whereas this is just 80.2, 80.4 GeV. And this is the measured value of the W mass, the yellow band, with the errors. And this is the theoretical prediction in the standard model. It depends weakly on the Higgs mass. And you see that they agree, but only if the Higgs is kind of 100 or maybe 200 GeV in mass. And so the success, the precision of the success of the standard model is important because it tells you that the Higgs mass, the Higgs, if it's there, has to be light. Light enough that it should be produced all the time at the LHC, and the problem is not producing it, it's seeing it. Okay, so we don't believe the standard model is true, and the short version for that is that because we know that dark energy and dark matter exists, something's going on there. Standard model doesn't predict that. You might have said maybe it's gravity that's wrong there, but a particle physicist includes gravity in the standard model. I just add general relativity. We had a conversation once about dark matter, I think to do with that movie, and one of the students said, well, what if there's a non-particle physics description of dark matter? And I remember thinking, that doesn't make sense. You know, if there's a non-particle physics thing of dark matter, then we're going to make that particle physics. So if it's a gravity solution, we're going to make that particle physics. Particle physics to a particle physicist is everything. And so we'll, anything will be particle physics. The other way we know the standard model is wrong is that the sun, these neutrinos I said were coming from the sun, they were only supposed to be one type. There's three kinds of neutrinos, remember, there's three copies of everything. But only the ones that were involved in neutrons turning into protons should have been coming from the sun in the standard model. So only the one neutrino should have been coming. But when people measured them, you can detect neutrinos by making a big enough tank and waiting for them to initiate a nuclear reaction, like they turn chlorine into argon, and you count the argon atoms or something. And so you can detect them, and they were always found to be fewer than were expected. And this was what was going on was nailed down by the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in the mine in Sudbury, where they had the first detector that could see all three kinds of neutrinos. And they were always looking for the ones that were expected to be coming, and there were always too few of them. But what they found in Sudbury was that if you look at all of them, there is fewer of the ones that you expected, but the other ones are also there coming from the sun. And when you add them all up, you get what you expect to see, given that you know how many fusion reactions are happening in the sun because you know how bright the sun is. So it was a huge success for Sudbury, but it was a big failure to the standard model. The standard model doesn't explain that or that or that, and so it's wrong at some level, and the question is, how do you fix it? There's theoretical problems which we won't talk about. So what do they do for the Higgs? Now we can cut to the chase. So you're looking for the Higgs. You don't see the Higgs because it decays in 10 to the minus 23 seconds. You see what it decays into. So what does it decay into? Well, there's an easy way to think about that. The way you got mass was you're moving in this picture from left to right. Here's you, you're a particle, and you interact with this Higgs thing. It's the property of the vacuum that's giving you mass, your interaction with it. And you interact with some strength, which we'll call lambda. It's just some parameter in the standard model. And you get a mass which is proportional to lambda. The way we measure this parameter lambda is we measure the mass, and that tells us how big the interaction strength is. And so your motion through the vacuum is what gives you a mass. But you can read this picture this way, where time goes that way, and it's the Higgs particle going along decaying into two things. And the strength with which it does that is set by the same thing, lambda. So it's proportional to the mass. So the rate with which the Higgs decays into things is larger the heavier the thing is it's decaying into. Because that's why the Higgs is there. It's there to give you a mass. The more you couple to it, the more mass you have. But that's how you decay, is through that same interaction. But you can't decay into something that's heavier than you are. So you decay into the heaviest thing that's lighter than half your mass. And that's what the Higgs will decay into. So what it decays into depends on how heavy the Higgs is, which we don't know. So what they look for depends on exactly how heavy it is. So I won't say that again, but that's kind of the, when they talk about a cross-section for a reaction, it's a different reaction depending on the mass that they're talking about. All right, so the one last thing you need to know before I show you what they understood is the second thing you need to know is that they're looking for a needle in a haystack. So one thing that they actually think they saw was the protons collide, a Higgs comes out, it decays into two photons, and they see the two photons. But there's a lot of things that produce photons at the LHC. And so here's a graph of the energy of the photon, number of photons that are produced at the LHC when there's a pair of them as a function of a particular measure of their energy, which I'll come back to. And you see that there's a lot of them being seen, and you have to pick the Higgs ones out. And so how do you do that? What you do is you say, I take my two photons, and I go to a frame of reference where the two photons are going in opposite directions, and I add up their energies in that reference frame. And that's what this variable is here. This is the mass of the energy of the two photons in the particular reference frame where they're moving in opposite directions. And they do that because if you're a photon that came from a Higgs decay, that Higgs decay in that frame, the Higgs particle was at rest in that frame, and the two photons that came out had to be going out in opposite directions to keep momentum balanced. But in that reference frame, if their momenta are equal and opposite, the magnitudes of their momenta are the same, and so their energies have to be the same. And so the energies of those two photons have to add up to the Higgs mass in that reference frame. So in this plot, what should happen is that all the photons coming from a Higgs decay will always be at the same place in this plot, whereas the ones that are coming randomly from other things will be all over the map. So they're looking for a bump to appear in this plot, and they're trying to pick it out of the noise. So now if you imagine that you see two photons come out, and that's all you've seen from the LHC, how do you know if that's a Higgs? The answer is you don't. If you see 20 million photons come out of the LHC, and you see that 3 million of them are all at one place, then you do, because that's very unlikely that that could have been a random fluctuation of 20 million photons. But it's a statistical thing that they're looking for, and that's why they're going to phrase everything in terms of a probability when I show you what they saw. So now what do they see? So this is a situation that they saw last summer, and this is the way that they describe it, these plots. So I'm going to show you this plot. Let me explain this plot, and then we can show you the same plot for Christmas, last Christmas, and then March. So what they're showing you here, they're showing you here a graph of something. This is a graph of the probability, the cross-section for producing a Higgs particle and having it decay into something they can see, say two photons. And they're doing it as a function of the mass of the Higgs across the bottom here. So that's in units of the mass of the proton. And we know that really it should be down at the bottom end here if we believe the standard model, because it says it should be light. Now what they're saying is that, now you run your experiment and you say you get 10 million events, and supposing you don't see any evidence for Higgs, then you can put an upper limit to the likelihood of the cross-section for the Higgs to have been produced. And that's what they're showing you here. They're showing you the dotted line is saying that if you give me some number of events, say an inverse femtobarn, then this dotted line is telling you the cross-sections that they can exclude. Any cross-section above that line can't be true, and any cross-section below that line can be true. And they've given you this answer for the cross-section not in barns or femtobarns, like I told you. They gave it to you in units of what the standard model predicts. So that's what this line one is. So when the standard model would predict that you're always at one, and when this line, the dotted line, is below one, then you can actually exclude the standard model. When the dotted line is above one, you can't exclude the standard model. But the dotted line is something you can figure out without doing the experiment. If I just told you how many events that have happened, you can tell me what cross-section you could hope to exclude. Now they actually do the experiment, and that's what the dotted line, the solid line is. And it should randomly kind of wiggle around the dotted line because it's a statistical thing, and the green and the yellow bands are telling you standard deviations around the prediction. But whenever you see an excursion up, that's something which is not looking like background, and an excursion down is something which is looking like it's not the standard model. And so you can see that last summer, this is a plot they showed last summer, they could exclude the Higgs, and wherever that solid line went below the line one, so they knew that the Higgs was not here and it was not here. And that's what they told us in July of 2011. So now we go to last Christmas. So what changed? What changed was they had 5 times more data than they had in the summer. And what you're expecting in that picture that I just showed you is that as they run the experiment, the line comes down because they're getting more and more events and it's more and more unlikely that you could have failed to see the Higgs if really there. And so eventually the line will come below one and then we'll know that the Higgs is not there and then the standard model is wrong. So what did they see? Now what they saw depends on whether or not you think the glass is half full or half empty. So I'll tell you both sides here. So here's what they saw. So this is the same plot for the one experiment, the CMS experiment. And so you see everything came down. The red line is the one line. So now the line is mostly below one. So they can exclude the standard model from a wide range of things. And that's the half empty version of it, that the standard model is not almost everywhere. So all this mass range here, where you didn't really expect it anyway, it's not there. It's also not, this was already excluded by the previous experiment. So there's only this tantalizing little window there. And if you blow up that little region, so now the scale on the bottom is different, you see there's a kind of a bump here, and it happens at about 125 times the mass of a proton. It's thereabouts. That's one experiment. So then the other experiment said what they saw. And here's what they saw. So same kind of a plot. Everything came down. They weren't quite so good at excluding things as the other experiment was. Mostly things are excluded. But there's still something going on at the low end. If you blow that up again, so then now there's a bigger scale here, you see that there's a bump. And where is the bump? It's at 125 GeV. And this plot is showing you that it's if you think of different reactions, like the Higgs decaying into two photons or the Higgs decaying into four electrons, say, or four leptons, those are what these different curves are. You see that two of them are bumping. Whenever a curve, this curve is the probability of what they're seeing being consistent with the absence of a Higgs. So whenever the curve dips down, it means that the assumption that there's no Higgs is very unlikely. And so that's unlikely, but when the mass of the Higgs is again 125 GeV. So it's what's kind of interesting is that there's more than one channel that's bumping at the same place. If this is a random fluctuation, what's kind of unusual here is that different reactions are doing it at the same place and different experiments are doing it at the same place. And that has the smell of not being too random. So what happened last month in March was that they haven't had more data, but they've analyzed more of it. And so this ATLAS experiment now can exclude things in more systematically, but they still have the bump at 125. This is of a conference at Morion in March. So what's that mean? So the thing you know for sure is that the standard model is not at a lot of places. It's not almost anywhere. So except for a little window around 125 GeV, we know that the standard model Higgs is not anywhere else. That's the thing that you know pretty much for sure. You can't really say that they've discovered the Higgs, but it's sociologically, it smells like when they discovered the top quark. It's one of those things where they're just now at the point where they've got enough events where they should be starting to see evidence for the Higgs if it has the mass of around 125 GeV. That's why the bump wasn't so far above what the dashed line was. And so right now you can't make a statistically convincing case that the Higgs is there, but it's very sociologically suggestive that different experiments and different reactions we're having a fluctuation, if we're unlucky, all at the same place. That smells like there's something there that they're seeing, but they don't yet have enough events to statistically conclude that it's there in a statistically significant way. And so I think that's the fair way to say what they've seen, is that they won't say that they've seen something, but they won't say that they've seen nothing. But we're going to know, very likely by the summer, there'll be stronger evidence. And by the end of the year, they should know for sure, because they're going to have, as much data again by June as they've accumulated to date at slightly higher energies, which helps also a little bit. And then they'll have that much again or possibly more by Christmas. And so I suspect we'll know for sure by Christmas. And there'll be a good indication in the summer as to whether or not this is going away. And so it looks like the standard model Higgs is gone, or the evidence for this is growing. And it probably won't be yet convincing, statistically significant. They asked for five standard deviations to predict, to say that they've got a discovery. And they're not likely to get that by the summer, but they're likely to see things heading in that direction by the summertime. This is a kind of a deceptive plot that I won't show you, really. If it's a standard model Higgs, it would be great. What I was going to do now is tell you what it would mean for other kinds of physics, but let me just skip that, and if someone asks, I can tell you again. But you'll see that there's one theory I think is right, which has a smiley face on it. And so you can ask me why if you want to know. So the bottom line is that the LHC has been running since 2009 successfully. And although it hasn't seen new things yet, possibly the Higgs accepted, it's changing how we think about things based on the things it has not seen. So one of the sad faces I skipped over there was people who believe in supersymmetry are kind of bummed out because they think that you should have seen superpartners to the particles we've seen, and they haven't. They also don't like a Higgs that's that heavy. And so the things that they have seen have already changed in an important way the way we think about particle physics. And when they turn on at the full energy, that's when that's the best chance we're going to have to really see something spectacularly new, because some things really require more energy, and just more events won't do it. And so that we'll have to wait for a couple years for, but it'll be worth the wait, I think. There's hints that the Higgs mechanism is right. We know of no way of making the weak interactions, even if you don't believe the Standard Model is true, all of the alternatives have some sort of vacuum physics giving everybody mass. So the only way we know to reconcile the properties of the weak interactions with the fact that everybody doesn't move at the speed of light is by assigning some properties to the vacuum, and they all require some sort of Higgs-like thing. It may not be the Higgs of the Standard Model, but every theory has its own version of the Higgs, because everybody has a vacuum through whose motion through which gives us mass. And so whatever that is, it's very likely the LHC is going to sort that out, because if it's the Standard Model, we'll know soon. If it's not the Standard Model, we'll know, but we may have to wait for it to turn on the second time around. But the hope is that we're going to get something much more exciting than the Higgs, that we're going to get something really not, it'll be coming out of left field and it'll kind of knock us over like a freight train, because that's when you really learn something. Don't ever do that experiment, because you really do learn something, but it's not so useful to you after you've learned it. So I hope that you keep your eye on the papers, and in the Melbourne meeting, which is in early July, there will be some sort of an announcement, which will probably not be completely conclusive, but it will be more conclusive than the one they had in December. And then towards Christmas, there's probably going to be another announcement where there'll be some definitive statement about the Higgs being there or not being there. So sorry for running over a little bit there. Thank you for your time.